Please be seated. Let's see.
He's getting it.
Yeah. Oh, there he comes. Okay. Now we can start. Let's cue. Okay. The second case for oral argument this morning is Leanne Stenstrom, appellant versus the State of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Mark Cady from the Minnehaha County Office of the Public Advocate, and for the appellee, we have Ms. Kelly Marnette, an Assistant Attorney General. With that, Mr. Cady, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. The appellant, Leanne Stenstrom, is living proof of how controlled substances can destroy someone's life. She's someone who suffers from an anxiety condition that she'd been fighting, and she had been fighting what was then a losing battle regarding an addiction to controlled substances. She entered drug court and relapsed on a number of occasions and made bad choices on a number of occasions. Residential placement was attempted at a halfway house in Sioux Falls, but through a strange and unfortunate coincidence, she was placed in the same housing unit as an individual who was romantically involved with someone who murdered her nephew. And her addiction, in conjunction with an anxiety condition, proved to be too much for her, and she made more bad choices. The drug court presented a termination report on October 26, 2015. Warrants were issued. She was arrested on warrants and appeared in circuit court on December 28, 2015. She filled out an application for court-appointed counsel, which was accepted, and our office was appointed. The drug court issued an additional termination report on December 31, 2015, but that one was ultimately not pursued by the state. Appellant's counsel inquired about drug court team meetings and was told that counsel was not allowed to attend. Appellant's counsel filed a motion to permit his attendance at drug court team meetings, citing state statutes and due process considerations. The drug court denied the motion, raising the issue before us. Is a drug court participant entitled to have her legal counsel attend drug court team meetings upon her request? I would suggest that de novo review should apply as to that issue. This is a matter of statutory interpretation and constitutional law. Does such a right exist? This court, I submit to you, however, doesn't even have to look at a single provision of constitutional law to decide that the answer to that question was yes, although you're certainly entitled to do so if you wish. The court needs to look at really just two statutes, 2346, which talks about under what circumstances court-appointed counsel is accorded to indigent defendants, and 1622.5.3, which discusses incorporation of the best practice standards regarding drug courts into our statutory scheme. So did the drug court err by denying our request? And the way that the matter proceeded, should that concern this court as to how the appellant was terminated? The state's brief suggests there is a conflict between the comments of the best practice standards and the black letter law of its standards. But there really is no conflict between them. The former backs up the latter. The best practice standards state that the NADCP chooses to combine aspirational and obligatory language, and that's in Volume 1, page 3. The standards at Volume 2, page 38, lists the composition of the team members. But it's important to note, however, that the standards also state the list is not limited to whom is listed in the standards. The comments help provide other examples of who can be on the drug court team. And it is specifically discussed how joint representation by the drug court defense representative and the participant's own counsel is contemplated. That's Volume 2, page 40. And it's followed by the next paragraph, as explicit mention to team meetings. Evidence suggests participants may be more likely to perceive drug court proceedings as fair
when a dedicated defense attorney represents their interests in team meetings. That's volume 2, page 40.
Well, doesn't the name itself suggest the answer when it says best practices? That tells me it's a recommendation.
The standards, I think the court's rule regarding incorporation of the standards, and cited in the state's brief, talk about how the standards are legal standards, the black letter law. And the comments help fill in what the black letter law means. We have a situation which is coming more regular in South Dakota, where we reach out and adopt standards from somewhere else. And when we do that, we buy the whole package. We did that with Marcy's Law. We got the whole package, whether we liked it or not. We got it. But this, arguably, is infinitely more likable.
You are, in essence, relying on language in the comments and not language directly in the standards. Is that true?
Not in all cases, Justice.
With reference to whether or not a separate defense lawyer is entitled to attend the drug court team meetings.
There is not as specific a mention other than an open definition of who can be included. However, when we interpret the standard and 2346, it would seem to suggest that attorneys are to be provided. You are entitled to an attorney if you are indigent, if you are under investigation. We don't have many files like that, but people will apply for court-appointed counsel and will be approved because they think some detective wants to talk with them about something. We get
what,
those files.
Are you trying to tell this court that if the police are investigating you, you can go to the courthouse and say, I want a court-appointed attorney?
I've had about six of those in the last 10 years. Yes. That's what's happening.
Okay.
So,
does it make a difference to your view whether or not this is, you know, in the comments, whether or not we're talking about a post-conviction program where, like this, it's a condition of probation after someone's been sentenced and versus a pre-conviction drug court, which there are differences, and do those comments differentiate between those two types of programs?
Well,
here we're talking about after conviction as a condition of someone's probationary sentence.
Yes.
They participate in this program.
Yes. And due process, if we can move away from the statutes, the statutes talk about probation matters are covered by the appointment of counsel statute. State versus Christian illustrates that. Once a probation proceeding is commenced or there's court action and the liberty interest has been implicated, they're entitled to court-appointed counsel.
But
and what usually happens...
isn't a revocation proceeding. This is a termination from a treatment program proceeding. Quite a bit different than a revocation proceeding.
Well, there are two proceedings that are involved in this case. The revocation proceeding occurred after the termination proceeding in drug court. My argument to this court in looking at how those proceedings commence, that they were essentially structurally combined. We have what I would submit respectfully would be some interesting language in a transcript of the drug court team's deliberations that mention that the court makes a finding that probation has been violated. That's the function of the circuit court, but it's being incorporated into the drug court team proceeding.
Well, wait a minute. They're two different proceedings, are they not? I mean, the drug court, simplest terms, is a treatment program or of sorts. And Judge Rypel, I believe, in this case, was involved in the drug court proceeding.
That's correct.
Revocation was Judge Howman in a separate proceeding.
Yes.
Now, there'd be a problem, I grant, if it was the same judge, the same, if it was all one proceeding, but they're two separate proceedings.
They are, but they were, when you look at what was stated at them, it appears that they were doing the same function.
Did she just misspeak by using the word probation?
There's too much. When you start, there's too much to have been just a mistake. When you start the drug court team private meeting saying, we're here for Leanne Stenstrom and her termination. That's a conclusionary statement. When you talk about probation being found to have been violated, that's a conclusionary statement in the context of the one I just mentioned and further things that are stated. I think the most telling comment that the drug court makes in this proceeding concerns prior to her final comments during the hearing, and I believe it was January 28th, states, all I can say is that I hope that you do something at the penitentiary that allows you to move forward. This is stated at the drug court.
Who said it?
This is the lower court, Judge Rappel, at the conclusion of the termination proceeding in drug court.
Well, she can say anything she wants, but it's Judge Hellman's call whether she goes to the pen or not. Judge Rappel doesn't have that authority in that context, does she?
She shouldn't, but she is acting as if she does, and you can see the effect it has on the drug court team. No one comments when they have an obligation to do so.
Either a revocation is legal or it's not. You can't have a de facto one signed by Judge Rappel. It'd be null and void because she doesn't have jurisdiction over the case. Judge Hellman does.
You said something else about, I'm sorry to...
Well, I was just going to give him an opportunity to respond to that, but I mean, maybe he doesn't want to.
He didn't look like he wanted to, so I thought there was a question in there.
Well, the question is, when there are concerns, and we have our church to be guarded by comments to some extent, in a court system that's supposed to be collaborative in nature and not necessarily adversarial, why are statements being made that suggest that it's over and done with? And who even needs that other hearing? It's over and done with.
If this wasn't a drug court, if this was a treatment meeting, I don't know, pick AA, mm-hmm. NA, whatever, isn't the corollary that you're saying that you should be allowed to participate with your client in any of those proceedings?
No, because there isn't the same type of liberty interest. We get involved when someone has been locked up because a warrant was issued for some sort of allegations of failing to comply.
But the result of that termination wasn't that Rappel didn't say that she's sentenced to the penitentiary, did she? She said you're terminated from the program.
Yes.
And other I think
but there's more to it than that.
In other parts of the transcript, I noticed that Judge Rappel said things like, you violated the terms of your of this program, not the terms of your probation. So to me, it looked like maybe she misspoke when she said to the team.
Well, if it was just misspeaking once, I would agree. But when we talk about, we're here to talk about her termination, that's the very first thing that is said. And then we're asking for votes, but no comments from members of the team when they are under an obligation to do so. And then we make a statement that doesn't need to be stated. I hope that you do something at the penitentiary. There's no need to make a statement like that. But when you sew them all together, it presents a problem.
But isn't a drug court recommendation kind of like an advisory jury in a civil case? I mean, it's not binding on the judge that makes the ultimate determination was Judge Hellman, right?
In terms of whether or not the person will be going to the penitentiary, yes, it is advisory and that the judge has the final say in that. However, the judge, in the tradition of what should be a collaborative effort, the standards, the black letter standards, not the comments, say she's supposed to take into account all the perspectives of the members of the team. That suggests that they should have something to say, something to be worth considering. And then you go to the comments that talk about how they've got an affirmative obligation to say something. And in this case, every member of the team said nothing. And that's strictly, that seems to be strictly at odds with what the comments are saying, which augment, more specifically in this case, the actual standard, which is statutory.
Backing up a bit, at what point then, under your argument, should the counsel have access to the drug court team meeting?
Well,
you're not sitting in there from day one, I assume.
No, but from a practical standpoint, that wouldn't happen. I was off the case following the initial judgment and sentence. And then I get notified about problems, and I'm appointed by the circuit court because the person is already in jail at that point. That's when there is a time of importance, is someone's already in custody. Their liberty interest is compromised. And unlike a treatment center just out there, a drug court has control over someone's liberty interest while in these programs.
So, like, your client stumbled several times.
Yes.
Okay. Every time she stumbles, that's not appropriate then to go give her an attorney. It's when she lands in jail, you say, is the time when the attorney should become involved?
Yes, and from there on in. And it's what happens in this case, because she is in custody, she applies for counsel, and she gets counsel. And so from there on out, she's involved in a drug court proceedings. And that's why 2346 is very important. We happen to have greater access to legal representation in this state than the federal constitution provides. That's the way it works here. That's the way it was shown to work in Christensen, Fred Albert Christian, back in 99. And once that happens, counsel clearly can see there's a problem. The participant is in jail. She knows there's a problem. There's someone there who can work with them and the team to find answers. I would argue that this was a structural error, but if the court is looking for prejudice here, let's consider this. If we have someone with an anxiety condition and an addiction condition, and the drug court team had a chemical dependency counselor and a mental health counselor, that would be Joy Parker, the person who I talk about in my brief. And so we have someone who comes into the meeting and votes to terminate, but wasn't there to hear their evidence. If Ms. Parker had been there to hear the evidence, she would have been aware that there's an anxiety condition, a triggering event. Is it just antisocial behavior that explains all this, or was it a mental health issue? And can we do something that treats both instead of just one? That was not there to be considered because she wasn't there for whatever reason. And but for the transcript being made, I would have known she wouldn't have been there.
And she wasn't permitted to vote.
I'm sorry, what?
She wasn't permitted to vote.
It does not appear to be that, because that statement is made right after her vote, so I'm assuming that that's who that was. But if that person was there, or if I was in there, I would say, I would say, oh, you weren't there? What did you miss? Did you hear about this event? Did you hear about the history of anxiety? Would you like to meet with her a little bit? Would you like to have her go back out? Let's go back outside and have her talk to you again. If I'm in there, I can suggest that.
So you're using this issue by analogy, her presence by analogy to yours in the drug court team meeting.
Yes.
All right, just trying to follow thread there.
It's not adversarial. It is collaborative. I'm suggesting another thing to be checked out.
So,
and it's checked out, and then...
You presented evidence, though, as counsel at the termination hearing to the drug court.
Yes.
And so it's only the drug court team meeting that you wanted the opportunity to attend.
That's correct.
And that's based on the language in the comments and the state statutes you referenced earlier.
Yes. And I would also cite federal due process to accent that. We've seen a history of, yes, it's a post-conviction proceeding, but due process extended into post-conviction proceedings through Morrissey, to parole proceedings, through to Gagnon versus Scarpelli, to probation proceedings, and to deferred sentencing proceedings. And we have a statute in this state that grants counsel to more situations than the federal government provides.
Is there a distinguishing factor here that your client volunteered for this program?
I don't think that there is, because even you still have due process rights even though you volunteer for something. A new event happens. She's arrested. Liberty interests are at stake, or their status is at stake. And she was appointed counsel before the court before I even made any of these arguments, because in South Dakota you get counsel.
Are you aware of any other courts that have ruled that defense attorney has this ability to go into team meetings?
No, I haven't seen that. I know that the state cites the Anderson case in its brief, which talks about due process rights going into drug court proceedings. And then when I look at comments, though, that explain what the standards mean, I see specific mentions about a defense counsel representative being for the general interest of all participants and it working together with different type of task functions with the defendant's own counsel. And the counsels also talk about how that right in terms of voluntary admission, a right to an attorney, isn't necessarily waived in perpetuity, especially when new events happen like being arrested. But just in terms of a practical nature, would it harm anything if another person was in the room in light of how many people are they in there already to add another perspective about that individual that might be pertinent? Would it harm anything? I don't think it would.
Okay, thank you. Counselor, your time has expired. Ms. Marnette, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Defendant was arrested and charged with possession of methamphetamine. She voluntarily applied for and was accepted into the drug court treatment program. Drug court is a supervised alternative to incarceration aimed at increasing offender accountability and decreasing recidivism. One of the key components is the use of a non-adversarial approach where the drug court team, which includes a prosecutor, a defense attorney representative, the drug court judge, law enforcement, treatment, a coordinator, sometimes in this particular circuit, a mental health professional, they all meet with the drug court judge in order to make recommendations regarding the drug court participants. I think the first thing that really needs to be addressed in this case is the issue of the waiver of the rights. I agree that the record does not reflect Ms. Stenstrom's written waiver. I included all the documents for this particular drug court as an appendix to my brief. And I realize Mr. Cady will argue that, well, there's no record that she signed it. The thing is, she couldn't have gotten into the program had she not signed it. Had she not signed the consent, the acknowledgments, agreed to all the terms and conditions in the handbook, she wouldn't be in the program. Therefore, we wouldn't be here arguing because she wouldn't have ever been in the program. So I think it is reasonable for this court to conclude that she had to have agreed to the terms and conditions. Just like somebody on probation, if they don't agree to the terms and conditions of probation, they're not going to get into probation. So to be in this particular program, she has to waive certain rights and make certain acknowledgments. She acknowledged that she has no right to be in the program and that she can be terminated at any time. That is waiver paragraph 3. She acknowledged that absconding from the program may result in termination. That's waiver paragraph 4. She acknowledged that she has no right to an evidentiary hearing to contest the imposition of sanctions and no right to appeal the decision of the drug court judge. She also acknowledged that the judge can terminate her from the program. Because of the way it's worded, I don't know that I can argue today that she has no right to even appeal the termination from drug court. But as far as other sanctions are...
In essence, she got the appeal, though. She got in front of Judge Holman, the original sentencing judge, right?
Well, yes, she did. She was able to argue why she should not be terminated from probation, which, as the court has already noted, is a separate proceeding from termination from drug court. Two separate judges and two different things that are going to happen or could potentially happen. Sometimes someone is terminated from a drug or a DUI court and they go before the circuit judge, the different circuit judge, and they don't necessarily send them to the penitentiary. Sometimes they will put them back on regular probation. Back when I was involved in DUI court, that happened on one of my cases where they were terminated from the DUI court, went to the circuit court, and the circuit court said, I'm going to try something different. I'm going to put you on regular probation. So it's not necessarily, as Mr. Cady wants this court to believe, an automatic termination from probation.
So are you arguing that there's no right to direct appeal from a termination of a drug or a DUI court?
Well, I'm saying,
is that what I heard you say?
So, I'm saying I can't go that far. But what I can tell you is in the same waiver that she makes, it says that she waives the right to an evidentiary hearing to contest the imposition of sanctions and no right to appeal the decision of the drug court. But then it goes on, the next sentence says that she also acknowledges that the judge can terminate her from the program. It does not specifically say that a participant cannot in some manner appeal her, as we are before this court, appeal her termination from drug court, which is what she's doing. Again, further waiver. She acknowledges that committing additional crimes may result in termination, just the same as a probationer would do. She waives her right to have an attorney represent her in the drug court program. And she acknowledged that the drug court team defense representative is not her attorney. She waives any conflict if the drug court team defense representative later represents her if terminated from drug court. When you look at that particular waiver, it presumes that a case could be where the actual drug court team member comes in when they are terminated and represents them at the termination or the violation of probation proceeding. As noted in Mr. Keady's brief, he had some concerns about the state's attorney being in the drug court proceeding and presenting the evidence of the violations of the drug court team and then going back and voting. But if you look at the waiver, it assumes that some of these attorneys can wear both hats. In this particular case, the state's attorney did present the evidence that was brought forward by the court service officer in the termination report, brought that to the judge. But you'll notice from the transcript that the state's attorney did not make any argument saying, yes, I believe that, you know, this supports that she violated termination. And there's nothing in the transcript where he came in and said to the drug court team, I, as a prosecutor, believe she needs to be terminated.
By the time they had that transcript was formed at that the termination hearing that brings us here today, there had been previous termination proceedings against Ms. Danstrom, correct?
Yes. In the summer of 2015, there was a termination report filed by court services after she had absconded from, I think, her first halfway house placement. And the team, I mean, we don't have the transcripts, but apparently the team must have decided that even if she had violated the terms and conditions of drug court, they were going to allow her to stay in.
They found something else they could do.
Right. And so they allowed her to stay in, and then they went to place her in further programs like 24/7 and program, and also into this other halfway house. And that's which led to her absconding again from supervision.
So Mr. Keady says, what would it hurt to have the defense attorney be at the staffing? What would your response be to that?
My response would be that we would be violating one of the 10 key components. What is supposed to happen in those team meetings is it's supposed to be non-adversarial. I think that's key component number two. If we don't follow that, we're really not following what all drug and DUI courts are supposed to be. They're supposed to be in this meeting as a team deciding what's best, speaking from their own specialties. So obviously the defense attorney representative has a little different viewpoint from the prosecutor. The mental health treatment provider would have a different viewpoint than the chemical dependency evaluator or the court service officer. And it's supposed to be collaborative. They're supposed to talk about what is best for this particular client and what do we need to do to also protect public safety. So that's what it would do. If we start adding an actual advocate in to the mix of the team meetings, it changes the dynamic of the team meeting. And again, we would not be following one of those 10 key components. I'd like to address a little bit the IP rules. I don't think that defense counsel had actually talked about those in his briefs. And I found out about them because Judge Howman actually mentioned it. When she came in for the actual termination hearing, she mentioned that she agreed with Judge Rypel's decision to not allow defense counsel into the team meetings. And she referenced an IP rule, which led me to do a little research and find these IP rules that this court has issued. And specifically, I'd like to look at two of those. One of them is IP Rule 2013-02, which gave guidance to the circuit courts in running their drug and DUI courts as far as termination. And in that, it talks about how if the team decides to pursue termination from drug court, that they'll be notified of that, and they're given the opportunity to address the drug court team concerning the possibility of termination at the next regularly scheduled court session. That happened in this particular case. After the court session, the drug court team will vote on the proposed termination. Again, that happened in this case. If the drug court judge agrees with termination, then the participant will be terminated from the program. Again, as you can tell from, although Judge Rypel didn't specifically say, I agreed with the team, she came out and said the team voted unanimously that you should be terminated from drug court. So we assume that she obviously was in agreement with that. In the IP rule says, in the event of termination, the court shall advise the participant of his or her rights concerning the potential probation revocation and shall appoint an attorney to represent the participant in the probation revocation proceeding. So again, this court's telling them you absolutely have to have an attorney appointed at the point that you're going to go forward into going to another judge and having the termination from probation brought forward. This court, the Second Circuit, actually gave Ms. Stenstrom an additional level of protection. They appointed, or this court appointed an attorney to represent her in the actual proceeding in front of the drug court judge. So she actually received some additional protections. I would also like to address SDCL 23A-40-6, which talks about the right to counsel. And I respectfully would have to disagree with Mr. Cady's reading of that. I can't speak to what's happened to him in his practice over the last 10 years. I guess I've never experienced, and I've not heard from other prosecutors, of any case where someone says someone is investigating me criminally and I'd like a court-appointed attorney. What the statute says is if it follows arrest or commencement of detention without formal charges. So I'd have to disagree. I think that if you find out you're being investigated for a burglary, you do not have the right to just go into the clerk of courts and say, I need an attorney. However, obviously, if you are arrested on that or you would be detained, that would be a different story. And again, SDCL 23A-40-6 talks about in an action for revocation of a suspended sentence or probation. Again, I agree that once Ms. Stenstrom had been terminated from drug court, she is entitled to an attorney for the probation revocation. As far as due process goes, she's entitled to all the rights that were set forth in Morrissey and Gagnon for parolees and for probationers who are facing a termination of those conditional releases. Going back again to the IP rule, the second IP rule I just want to briefly talk to you about is this IP rule 2016-02, which this court said we're going to adopt the black letter substance of the National Drug Court Best Practices Standards. I understand there are comments there, and the commentary can be looked at by a court for clarification. However, I think that the black letter standards actually answer our questions. Looking at standards 1, page 21, the judge makes the decisions after taking into consideration the input of other drug court members and discussing the matter in court with the participant or the participant's legal representative. Again, that is directing that what is happening in the drug court team is different than what is happening out in the court, where the drug court judge will discuss the case with the participant and potentially with their legal representative. Also, standards 1, page 26, participants are given the opportunity to explain their perspectives and may allow the participant's attorney or legal representative to assist in providing such explanation. That occurred in this particular case. Ms. Stenstrom and her attorney were allowed to talk to the members of the team who were presumably sitting in the courtroom about why they should not terminate her from the drug court, but should give her additional opportunities. At that point, she was able to talk about what had happened to her at the halfway house and her concerns with the anxiety and all of that. The team was able to consider all that.
All right, Ms. Marnett, in this case, there are two different judges, Judge Rappel in the drug court proceeding and Judge Howman. Is that always the case, that there are two separate judges, or could it be the same judge in both proceedings?
I believe the best practices would indicate that it should always be a different judge.
Would there be due process issues if there was not?
There could be. There could be, because we're looking at the judge who was very much involved in knowing everything about the participant, making decisions as the drug court judge. And obviously, in this case, it appears that Judge Rappel knew, or believed that she should probably go to the penitentiary at that point after failing all of the efforts that they had used with her. So there could be a due process issue if it was not a separate judge. And finally, the other standard, which is standard 2 on page 38, in the standards 2 on page 38, that the staff meetings are presumptively closed to participants. I believe what Ms. Stenstrom is asking is for an attorney to go and represent her at something that she is not allowed to be at. When you think about representation, you think about that person is with you. They stand in your shoes. They make those arguments for you. In this particular case, in open court, she was allowed to make her arguments as to why she should stay in drug court. And her attorney was also able to vocalize his reasons why he thought she should stay in.
Now, counsel, you've brought us through the black letter provisions of the standards. Are there portions of the comments that support Mr. Cady's position?
There are some conflictions in there as far as when a private attorney or a separate attorney can come into the proceeding.
The drug court team meeting.
Into the team court meeting. It does reference a private attorney at some point being in there. But again, this court has not adopted the commentary. We specifically adopted the black letter, and so that's what we are with. Obviously, if this court decides that they want to change how things are done in the team meetings, and again, my concern would be that it becomes adversarial, which is not what the drug court is supposed to be, that it really changes how we are directing our drug and DUI courts, other specialty courts in this state, and so that would be my concern.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions.
Nobody's chewed out for quitting early.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Cady, you have 10 minutes or 3 minutes.
A couple of things. Just so everyone knows, and I was surprised to find out that I could represent someone who was being investigated. 23A40-6 says, in the first clause, in any criminal investigation or in any criminal action or action for revocation of suspended sentence, it clearly distinguishes active cases that are going on and investigations. Is that broad? Sure it is. Absolutely, it's broad. And I don't, I'm surprised I don't get as many cases like that as you would think. We haven't put them on bumper stickers yet, but it's one of those situations where people come in and they ask about the law, they ask about their rights, and then maybe one of the reasons they prosecutors don't hear about it because they don't get charged anymore. Maybe we tell them to cut it out. I mean, it's one of those things. It's there. It's not known. But county records will show we get appointed on it pursuant to that statute. It happens. With regards to the 10 components and the non-adversarial nature that the presence of myself or another defense attorney would create, if that would create an adversarial context, wouldn't the presence of the prosecutor who brings a termination report and then goes to the team meeting present an adversarial context? If that's how it's defined. The prosecutor doesn't get up and leave during the admittedly advisory vote. He stays in there. So if that's the test, the drug court in this situation has problems making it. We just have a very unusual situation where we got a transcript. I've never heard of that happening before. I don't know if it has ever happened before. But when you actually see it, you see how things aren't in accordance with the standards and the comments. And the state stresses, oh, you adopted the black letter standards, but you didn't address the comments. But they're not giving you a reason why you should ignore the comments. We don't tell people when we're looking at the model rules with regards to attorney conduct, oh, just don't pay attention to that. Don't read that stuff. That's not what they teach you in law school.
Well, but in like the Uniform Commercial Code, which has very lengthy comments, we've never adopted the comments. We say they're advisory best practices, but they don't carry the weight of law like UCC would.
I accept that. But what I'm saying is, why ignore it? It doesn't necessarily mean you ignore it. It's they're taking a position that is in opposition to what the defendant is wanting, and they're backtracking to justify it by saying, oh, you didn't adopt those, so you just ignore those. Because you have to ignore those to get their position.
So
why have them?
We're one of the last states in the nation to develop a drug court protocol. And so I'm wondering what the rest of the states in the nation are doing with reference to this question.
Well, I haven't seen a lot of appellate litigation written on this. And maybe it's because there haven't been perceived problems between looking at the comments and using them to to help fill in blanks that are in the standards.
All right, so what's
they're all using those standards.
Can you follow up on her argument regarding waiver?
Well, yes. Well, there's a couple things about waiver. First off, we had a hearing, and no one submitted this contract that was actually signed. You look at the sentencing transcript, and it talks about being put on standard probation and following drug court requirements. It doesn't talk about the individual things about signing papers and whatnot. That was at a period of the case where I wasn't even involved anymore. And so it's not on the record. And when my colleagues at the Attorney General's office talk about something I might be raising that is in the record, they say you waived it. So in this particular case, we'll be citing on that's not an issue. That's not a fact in this case that was put into the record, and it should not be determinative. It also seemed to have been an attempt to talk about appellate waiver or appellate jurisdiction of a drug court termination order. That wasn't mentioned below or in their brief. And so I haven't had time to talk about that or address that. We have orders that are affecting liberty interests. The drug court, unlike a treatment center, can keep someone in jail. And so there has to be some sort of review or relief that could remedy a situation if things go not as they should. That's all I would have to say because I wasn't raised until now. So I would ask you to tread down that path with some due caution. And this is a unique case. You don't have that contract in the record. If you did, if that was brought up, maybe there'd be evidence brought by me to say whether or not it was voluntary or it was consent that was later revoked. The comments written by very experienced people on these matters actually list cases that say, with regards to waiving rights to an attorney, that the best practice standards or the themes of the whole approach talk about increased attorney involvement because it makes it sound, it makes the court figure more fair. And that's the kind of language we saw in the Morrissey decision, where they talk the state has an interest in making sure the parole proceedings are perceived as being fair. It's not the greatest interest, but it's an interest nonetheless. I just don't think there'd be so much harm to have someone else in the room who might have noticed someone was missing, the psychologist on the team might have been missing, and maybe we should have a reset. Maybe they should talk to each other. How many seconds of my argument here did that take? A couple of seconds. It's not that big of a state's interest that's being compromised to have another person in the room. They use the jury rooms in the Second Circuit. There are 12 chairs in there. Plenty of room. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gady. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.